Welcome to What If, the Futures Legal Podcast.
I'm Hasti.
And I'm Rana.
Every episode, we ask a bold what if question and explore how law might evolve to meet the future.
From AI to space and everything in between, we explore how law, policy, and society adapt when the future arrives faster than we expect.
Because every what if brings us one step closer to the future of law.
Let's get started. Hi everyone, if you're new here, welcome to What If, the Futures Legal Podcast, and if you've been listening for a while, welcome back. This is the final episode of our three-part Insight into the World of Artificial Intelligence series.
Today's question is, what if compliance in AI isn't enough? The EU's AI Act took years to negotiate and was already behind by the time it was actually passed. The UK went the other way, with a much lighter regulation and more emphasis on innovation, actually. But that raises the real question, should companies actually go beyond what the law demands?
To help us think this through, we have invited someone very well positioned within this debate. Dr. Emre Kazım is the co-CEO and co-founder of Holistic AI, a platform that helps enterprises audit and govern their AI systems. Emre, could you maybe start by introducing yourself and your academic and professional background, and maybe also telling us a little bit about why you think this question matters right now?
Awesome. Thank you so much for this invitation. I'm Emre Kazım. I'm co-founder of Holistic AI. I found myself accidentally in the AI space. I did my undergraduate in chemistry, my postgraduate in kind of research, chemical physics. And then I ended up doing my PhD in philosophy. So nothing to do with philosophy of science or philosophy of technology. Ended up doing it in Kant, so German moral philosophy or ethical philosophy. So I had a real interest in kind of foundational questions, but I was following the world as it was changing. And then I got interested in how new digital technologies are forcing us to renegotiate the social contract. So I ended up really quite fortuitously in the computer science department of UCL. And I was working with these engineers, and it was a lot of speculative questions about the problem of, let's say, trust in AI or in artificial intelligence. So the kind of core problem was this. We're going to be having, or we are having, a kind of Cambrian explosion in the use of AI in industry and the world writ large. And the defining force of the use of AI will be trust, which means how can we be confident that these systems actually work? So we've got lots and lots of examples of that. Things like people use, or companies using AI to sieve CVs. And then you see these kind of systematic exclusion of women or people with non-Anglo-Saxon names and so on. And then there's other examples where there was a very famous trading algorithm, a company called Knight Capital, and it glitched. And then it wiped out like hundreds of millions from the business and it went bankrupt. So you had these kind of desire to use AI, but really we had to be confident that these systems actually work. So that was the academic problem that we were trying to solve. And it was being done in a highly interdisciplinary manner. So that's how I ended up as somebody with a background in philosophy in the computer science department. And we were just experimenting in this space. We published lots of papers. And then my co-founder, who was very much an engineer, an AI engineer, and I were like, you know, should we just do this in the real world? It's like trying to study medicine in the library. You know, you got to be in the hospital to do that. So we just decided to just spin the company out and we got going. So what we do as a business is basically provide a platform for companies to risk manage their AI.
Thank you.
That was insane. Yeah. I was just smiling here. I felt so proud. That's just incredible.
Small thing, actually. When we were looking at your bio, it's the first time we've ever, both of us, have come across co-CEOs in a company.
That was very interesting. But you know, that sounds great. Philosophy, computer science. I'm kind of jealous. I always feel like I don't have enough time to, like, I don't know, do enough of education or just like learn enough. But then I think that's a great example. It's never too late to do whatever you like.
Do you know what? I will say this to people listening. I wasn't pragmatic. Right? I wasn't thinking, oh, you know, what's the move I'm going to make to maximize my earning potentials. And funny enough, I'm not saying this works out every time, but I've been very lucky that my curiosity has actually led to a situation in which I can kind of live off the back of it.
Yeah, definitely.
But I encourage following your curiosity highly.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice.
Yeah, I feel like, I don't
maybe
know,
a bit lacking at LSE, even.
Probably, I think, yeah, everyone just wants to kind of, you know, get the best job, get the best career going, but sometimes you might not even like what you're pursuing, so I feel like it's really important to not just, like, blindly follow something. But maybe enough of that. Moving on to the actual episode, I think before we start with the questions, it would be really nice to get a sense of feeling of what Holistic Air actually does. So it'd be really nice to maybe tell us a bit more about what an AI Governance platform actually looks like, but also, what are your typical clients?
So let's say you are a large company, and what's happened is every single time since 2022, 23, it was the end of 23 when it really exploded when ChatGPT came out. But what you are doing is you're opening up your newspaper or you're putting on the news, and all you're hearing is AI, AI, AI. Mm-hmm. So you say, okay, right. There is this race, there's this to kind of transform the business to become AI native, AI first, and really kind of motivate this adoption of AI within the business. Now, how do you go about doing that? So initially, a lot of companies were just spending money in a very kind of experimental way. And that's actually useful. So even if it doesn't result in kind of productivity, it still results in kind of knowledge acquisition. So you just learn things. You just learn how to use these technologies. But as we're maturing, companies are saying, okay, so we've got AI in the company. Some of it's productive, some of it isn't. But how on earth do we govern these systems? So we got effectively a number of pain points when it comes to governance. So the first pain point is, how do you know what exists in the business? So somebody very high up in the business needs to have a bird's eye view of how many AI systems or where AI is being used in the business. So that's a problem, what we call it as a problem of discovery or inventory. And if it's not, if you don't have a solution, then you have something which we refer to as shadow AI. So our platform does that in the first instance. It surfaces and kind of gives you a bird's eye view of what's happening across the business. Then every single system that you're using, you want to know the risks associated with it. So we do a risk assessment. And then you might find some problems. And so you would have to do verification, which would actually just be testing to say, hey, we think this is risky, but, you know, is it actually risky? And then you move on to like mitigation, which is just to take remedial actions. And then you would do kind of monitoring of those systems. Now, so I guess the first problem that we solve is providing a tool which allows them to do this at scale, all of the above. Secondly, we are still very much committed to foundational research. And it turns out testing and verifying algorithmic systems is very difficult and requires lots of research. So it's still, we feed that into the platform. And then finally, probably most prescient for this conversation is there's a tsunami of policy and regulatory activity. So we help companies do all of that work in a way that's auditable. So you've got a kind of track of what's taking place and it conforms to a lot and provides the kind of documentation that provides a lot of the evidence of this, of that kind of, let's call it not so much compliance, but let's say compliance readiness.
Yeah, that's a great explanation. Yeah. Thank you. We were also thinking that it might be useful to just flag what like a SaaS business is as well, because that's something that came across when I was looking into Holistic AI. Like from my understanding, that it might be a bit useful for listeners to compare it to a case management system, for example, that law firms might use, but it's more for like tracking risk across an organization. But could you maybe explain
that's right.
a bit more?
So do you know what the fundamental difference is what we do? So in the UK, we have one of the world's most advanced ecosystems of consultancy. So a consultancy is basically a company that does something like project-based and they work with other enterprises. So, and law firms in a similar way provide a service. And in both cases, typically they bill by the hour. So they work out what the cost of this thing is. They work out how much human beings are needed, how many graduates, how many seniors, and all the rest of it. And they create a figure, and then that's how they get compensated. So what we do with software is very different, which is companies will license our software. So they'll say, we're going to pay you a certain amount of money for a certain amount of consumption. And then they get to basically use the software to be able to do this at scale. So software as a service, which is what SaaS stands for, is the typical business model, or licensing of software is the typical business model for technology companies. Has been disturbed. So like, for example, if you look at Anthropic and ChatGPT, they're pay as you go, you know, people paying it. So there is a lot of actually flux in how we, the business model of technology companies, but at the core, software companies want to license people to license their software.
Yeah, and I think one last thing that would be probably very useful is understanding the difference between what governance means and what compliance means. So could you maybe briefly tell us a quick definition of the two and why you think they differ?
So compliance is a formal requirement, enacted by some public body. That is a kind of legal codification of the requirements needed to operate in a particular market. So it's very much about meeting to the letter of the law, literally, what has been dictated or decided upon by, say, a legislator and so on. Governance is way more than that. So compliance, you can think of it as a subset of governance, and governance is a much broader umbrella. So let me give you some examples of where something might be compliant, but still has an issue of governance, right? So let's say a typical concern about compliance would be things to do with our, say, civil rights. So a concern might be, does this algorithm adversely impact a person based on their demographic background or their demographic, you know, their demographics? So that might be a legal requirement. Now, a company might, so there may be another concern, which is in a different context that has nothing to do with impacting a particular person. So it's not credit scoring, it's not CV, it's not human capital management. And the company will say, there's no compliance requirement, but you know what? I want to know how well this system is working, you know, because it has a huge impact on our business, you know? Yeah. So you can have all of these risks associated with AI that are non-compliant, that have nothing to do with, sorry, that are not to do with compliance. And basically the way that you would address those issues, or you would address those concerns, are the broader questions of governance. Another thing is that governance, you can think of it, if you want to tie it to compliance, is that there are different ways in which you would become compliant. So compliance is just the formal requirement, but there are a whole bunch of ways in which different companies would approach that, and governance is a part of that. So good corporate governance, good tech governance, generally speaking, compliance is one part of it, but it can often be a very small part of it.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say that, based on what you said, that what the approach in like this episode is going to be whether the law and like compliance requirements should be the ceiling rather than the floor, you know, mm-hmm. where they should just be a starting point, which it sounds like they are when you look at the broader scope of governance.
So I think two things. One is probably the closest analogy was there was a public concern about privacy. And the GDPR came along and they created a very strong compliance requirement. And then you could see that there's like a general disappointment in the GDPR. Which is, it ended up with these kind of absurd situations where you had cookie banners and, clicking consents. So it felt like companies had solved the compliance problem, which they had, right? Like you're clicking on these. But, you know, did we really gain our privacy? So one of the concerns about compliance is that it creates a compliance market, but doesn't actually solve the problem. Or that it's trying to solve. So it creates lots of work for lawyers and other kind of policy bots, but, you know, does it actually solve the problem? And I'll give you an example. Cybersecurity is not primarily driven by compliance. But, you know, if a company gets hacked or if there's like big problems, it has such a huge impact on the business that you actually have a very robust and mature cybersecurity industry. So it's not synonymous. Governance and compliance are not synonymous.
Are you saying that a lot of the time, like a company's governance will be centered around like the commercial impact that a slip up could have?
Operational impact, commercial impact. It's just imagine, you know, you've got this part of compliance, great, but actually you've got this big company, you know, how am I going to govern these things? Or could be even things like, where are we spending the money? How much money are we spending? You know, what's the escalating? Often companies have a taxonomy of responsibility. So they escalate if something goes wrong. So all of these things have to do with governance.
Yeah. Our first question was about the UK's recent more pro-innovation approach and whether you think that's the right call. So the UK's made a conscious choice not to introduce any AI-specific legislation, which has been framed as a competitive advantage that avoids the bureaucratic weight that the EU AI Act, for example, brings. And it's a twofold question, I guess. Do you think that this creates an accountability gap if there isn't one specific regulatory body that's equipped to fill this? And maybe the first part of this, you could start by just explaining who actually governs AI in the UK.
So it's so let me start off with, I think the second question, I think it's impossible to answer that question. You know, it's not a particular body. It's not a public body. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. So there's like a bunch of them. The ICO is involved. The Competition and Markets Authority is involved. I'm actually on a Bank of England FCA, Financial Conduct Authority group, AI consortium. And actually, it's very explicit that our findings or what we're publishing is not law. Mm-hmm. It's very much advisory. So there is still a vibrant debate and discussion amongst important public bodies, some of which are, okay, for example, in addition to public bodies, so the civil service and regulators, sector regulators, there's lots and lots of NGOs and other parties, some international, some UK-based. So we don't really have an answer to that question. There isn't a single authority, which I guess was the whole point in the UK's approach. The second thing about the first question, I think you were getting at, is there an accountability gap? I think it just depends on how you think AI is going to evolve. So one of the things I'm surprised by, if you look at all the papers that we published, a lot of our papers are from 2020, 2021, 2022. And we thought by the middle of the decade, the whole question of what the public standard would be or what standards would have been solved. I thought the first half of the 2020s was going to be codification of these public standards and bodies. And the second half of the decade that we're in now, 26 to 30, was going to be us making strides on codifying the technical standards. So it's taken longer than I thought it was going to take. Yeah. So it's not even so much about a competitive advantage. So a critique of the EU AI Act is, as you've hinted multiple times, that it's already redundant, that the technology is moving so quickly, mm-hmm. that the attempt of the language 2 years ago, or whatever it was, is already kind of, more and more out of touch with what's taking place. So there is a strange kind of dynamic here, which is, do you do nothing, wait and see, or do you get ahead of it? I understand what the EU was trying to do. I also am profoundly sympathetic to those who say that it's not a great piece of legislation.
Yeah, and I was actually reading a lecture from Baroness Lloyd, who's the Minister of Department of Science and Innovation and Technology, and she was exactly echoing what you said. AI is moving so fast. If we have this specific body or law that can govern that, that can immediately change, even like after 1 to 3 days. I mean, AI platforms are evolving like in a few months, and that's just like incredibly hard to maybe govern and regulate, yeah. in a sense. But I kind of had a philosophical question, saying you've done philosophy before. When awesome. The white paper was out from the Conservative Party, it had about 5 principles in it, which was contestability, which means we should be able to challenge what AI says, accountability, yeah. transparency, safety, fairness. But kind of you know, when it comes to AI governance and trying to regulate these and actually consider all these five principles, the issue is there's no kind of universal definition of what these five principles might actually mean. For example, I feel like even me and Rona or yourself could have very different perceptions of like what these actually mean. So how should systems of governance deal with this? And in an ideal world, who should actually be responsible for defining these?
Do you know what? So I'll indulge the philosophy now. So there's two contradictions within me. The Brit in me, and then there's that the Kantian in me. So, you know, I've come to realize from a kind of philosophical perspective, I'm all in with the Germans. You know, like first principles, blah, blah, blah. But the Brit in me, and the more I've done things in the world, we've got the best legal system in the world because we don't define.
Yeah.
Like the reason we've got such a phenomenal legal system is precisely because we don't provide those kind of, that some incident is going to happen.
Exactly. We don't even have the Constitution.
You know, yeah, we're on the Constitution.
Yeah.
And so it's, I don't mind, actually. I think we are, we look at our kind of, let's say our Anglo-Saxon legal system, which the US has adopted and then kind of did some rubbish thing by having a constitution, which was a terrible thing for them to do. It deals with these things exceptionally well. Mm-hmm. You know, in theory, it deals with it in a lot, in a way that's way better. And I suspect that's what's going to happen here. So, like, I take your frustrations. I understand them. But I think we're in a good position because it's so indeterminate. I understand the principles that they stated as kind of generally understood. So each one of them might not have formal definitions, but we get it here. You know, we understand as Brits, you know, that we kind of get what we mean by it contestability, you know. It's things like, you know, disclosure. It's like a reasonable mechanism by which to request information. Reasonable, all these words like reasonable,
yeah,
you know, which a continental philosopher would be horrified by. It probably makes sense, especially for technology governance.
I feel like the reason I asked that is kind of playing devil's advocate, but I definitely agree. I feel like even, like, we had a few judge events in the past few months through Women in Law Society, and one thing that was echoed here and there every single time was the system works because we can, you know, interpret every single word that is in a statute and actually make sure that is, you know, compliance or, like, kind of, you know, intact with the issue in this case specifically. So I think not having, you know, strict principles of, you know, this means that means that, just do that, just do this, that wouldn't work, especially like with AI and how fast it's moving.
I think the bigger problem we have in the UK is the size of our market. So it may be, we may extol the virtues of our legal system, which I'm all in on, but don't have the kind of power we had. The EU, by sheer force of its size of the market, to access its market, ends up kind of dictating these. Our ability to have that flexibility and do that work is advantageous. However, in order for it to have these cascading effects, that's a more difficult thing.
I just wanted to push a little bit on like the pro-innovation framing, because there's also an argument that having clearer regulation could actually enable innovation. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's funny. I've always, it used to be something that we were quite actively involved in, that debate. And I just think it's not, I think something like a reality hit when Trump came into power. So I was shocked at how quickly the EU repealed its, or withdrew the AI liability directive. And that was, I think it came in early January. And I think they got rid of it by, or they withdrew it by February. I guess it was 25. And so part of me is just thinking the body that makes a virtue of, you know, we need responsible, the EU, was also like taking a step back and saying, is AI so important that if we're not at the bleeding edge of this, and if we're not the kind of, if we don't own this, then we can't meaningfully govern it. And my suspicion is that that's probably true. So it becomes a kind of, are we going to pontificate at the edge? Are we saying that not others innovate and dominate this space and then we regulate? And it's like, no, we don't really want to do that, you know, because we're pretty confident in our research institutions, in our own companies, you know? So I think it's a geopolitical question. Mm-hmm. It's way more top down than we thought it was. Because often the way we used to approach the question was framed from the individual enterprises. From the enterprise perspective, it makes complete sense to put guardrails in, to have good governance in the experimentation and adoption of AI across the company. Mm-hmm. It enables it. So, you know, we still, I think the tagline at Holistic was for many years, we enable enterprises to adopt and scale AI with confidence. So it was kind of resolving that issue. But within the broader public debate, I think it's a bigger question for us all to ask. Do we have enough currency in this economy, global economy, in this technology adoption to meaningfully govern these things, to have a meaningful voice in governing these things?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And like the second question that we had was more focused on the EU AI Act. I don't know how familiar you are with it, but we want to talk about how it categorizes risk and how, yeah. For example, based on like the use of AI, medical AI, employment AI, for example, being treated as high risk, and whether you think that is realistic in a practical sense for two products with very different uses to be put in the same category of risk.
If you've got our publication history, we used to actually publish on the draft documents of the AI mm-hmm. Act. And so we had a very kind of encyclopedic knowledge of the shifting interests amongst different, at different points. Cause you know, the chair used to move. So you'd have like different bodies, like Slovenia at one point. I think France was at another point. Cyprus, was it that? Maybe it's my Cypriotness coming out in there. But, so it was funny when they introduced this list of high risk systems. Cause that is Anglo-Saxon, right? Mm-hmm. Then there was like a subsequent intervention, which I read as gave a kind of definition of high risk. So I think they were trying to solve this problem, which was to say, we want to be more prescriptive. But at the same time, we need to provide this kind of more generic definition so that outside of those use cases, if something meets the stand, this more generic idea of or notion of high risk, it can capture it. I actually think it was the right decision to introduce the list. I think the idea there is it might not be actually to say the way you will risk manage this is the same, but these are high risk systems. And that makes sense, right? So I agree. Medical context seems different to me than the use of AI in education. But it's sufficiently worrisome that we call both of them high risk. Yeah. It's just that it's going to cash out in different ways.
I just had one question just to clarify. I would like to like know your thoughts on, do you think this category-based approach actually causes a problem in terms of like, does it miss something fundamental about, you know, how AI systems actually behave once they've been deployed? Or do you think there's not much of a problem?
So the way we think about it is that it's an indication of inherent high risk or inherent low risk. Mm-hmm. So it's not about remember, it's just category of the kind of use case is this is a high-risk system. Mm-hmm. So the point that you're making is, I think, absolutely the case, which is, let's say you've identified it as a high risk. Then the whole story about, okay, then how do you validate that? How do you monitor it? Do you use continuous monitoring? What are the concepts of drift? So how do you ensure that when it's in the real world, it doesn't just start doing things that are outside of the remit, which gave you the right to sign it off as controlled risk, you know? So there's lots of problems in the execution, lots of interesting work in the execution of how, once you've actually identified something as high risk, how do you reduce the the risk to an acceptable level, or how can you be confident that it's now an acceptable level, and then how do you monitor it? So that's all the interesting technology stuff. I think the real force of it is more to do with inherent risk. It's general categorization of those use cases. But I agree. I mean, if you then end up in situations where you say, okay, you can imagine this will be a kind of compliance gaming where they say there's a system that's inherently high risk. A generic way of addressing that is by saying, we introduce this kind of human in the loop, which becomes a kind of rubber stamping of everything, mm-hmm. but you've introduced human in the loop. And then you still have a system which is controlled, but actually still high risk. Yeah. So I take that point. So there's like almost all the other work is taking place outside of in terms of innovation and how to actually govern and test and monitor these things.
Yeah. Just another observation, and maybe from your perspective, this isn't true, but you could say that there's been like a move in the language surrounding AI from AI ethics towards, and this applies to like corporate, you know, AI governance, and but also regulation, from AI ethics to auditing trustworthy AI. Do you think that's because ethics is, you know, too contested to be able to anchor?
That is exactly right. And I think it's healthy. I can imagine a situation. So let's talk about the difference between something being compliant and something being ethical. So let's say you've got a system and you think, right, this is compliant. So I know I can use it. It's controlled. But a company might step back and say, do you know what? It's just going to have such a devastating impact on X part of the labor force that actually we want to think about whether we should use it. So another example might be a situation where a system is very well managed, it's compliant, but it has a huge energy cost, you know? So you might think, you know, is it worth, you know, and the damage that's going to do, let's say, to some environmental context. So you might think of a situation there and say, okay, it's compliant, but is it ethical? Now, typically companies have some values, but those values are assuming compliance. So ethics is too contested. Mm-hmm. It's too fluffy. It's a domain which actually bleeds into politics.
Yeah.
Because if you feel sufficiently motivated by a particular ethical issue that you feel like something should be illegal, mm-hmm. then it becomes... So it is... Okay, we won't answer this question, but what is the law? You know, I don't think this, but I think one way of reading the law is that, is it codification of our ethical intuitions? Whereas like my reading of the law is more procedural. It depends on what we think the law is doing. But if we feel sufficiently strongly about something, then it probably goes from being something we feel ethically motivated to drive into, to force an action. But it's the language shifted, I think, in a healthy way, away from that. So with my PhD in philosophy, you know, does that give me particular moral insight? You know, should I charge people or companies to pontificate about the meaning of AI? You know, I'd love to do that from a personal, you know, but no, you know, that's not what we sell. Mm. You know, we sell like systematic, you know, formal governance. Mm.
You say the law is procedural. Can I just ask what you mean by that?
I just meant that there's different areas. Like generally speaking, we're concerned about what are reasons. So we might say, for example, that there's some disclosure requirements, reporting requirements, and you just have some, and you think, okay, that's reasonable, right? All companies should, or they may need to disclose or report on in particular areas. You can imagine risk in banks, for example. And then I think so. That's different to us saying, okay, you need to do an assessment of the impact of this on this part of the labor force. Mm-hmm. You know, which seems like a more ethical question mm-hmm. or a more kind of disputed question. And my point was to say, if something becomes so important to society, then usually we would see them try to codify. We would see them try to take some kind of legal, try to codify this in a legal fashion. But if it occurs to me that generally speaking, what the legislator is doing, especially in these kind of things that we're describing, is saying, okay, what's the public good? But balancing that with a need to innovate and so on and so forth. So it's creating the kind of structures or the language or the statutes that says, okay, how can we ensure that everybody understands the rules of the game?
So the laws, you know, so like important to me to see what other people think about what the law is, how does it work? So that was really interesting to hear. But kind of final question was about how companies actually use, you know, AI governance in practice. And like we said, regulations are quite behind. So what does it mean to be proactive? And is there a real business in actually wanting to become more in terms of governance rather than compliance? And what are the pros and cons of actually taking the governance approach rather than compliance?
I guess the idea would be that you would do compliance as a part of a broader governance initiative. The question of our age, the question is, how can we use AI effectively? You know, like, I laugh about this. I think the internet was like the world's most intuitive technology. And still, that took about 30 years to mature. Now you've got entire industries, you know, the whole world is on the web. I mean, just think about the profound impact it's had on, you know, e-commerce, on our social lives, and so on and so forth. Now, AI is transforming industry. And in the same way that, and we always use this example, is that Blockbuster didn't become Netflix, right? The telephone wasn't invented by BT. So you had these big incumbents and these startups, in quotes, came along and just like revolutionized those industries. So these companies are facing down the barrel of a gun, which is, you know, this is so disruptive. This is so transformational that in the same way as, you know, I think it was like 20 years ago, 25 years ago, the biggest companies were like oil companies, and so on. And then we went into this kind of, now we got a company, all of them are what, Amazon, Apple, you know, Google, the biggest companies in the world are probably going to be AI native in 20 years time. So like the problem that companies have is AI transformation. And you got to be, and AI governance effectively, allowed you to do that. So that's the actual core problem that they're trying to solve, is accelerating transformation across the business. And they use governance as a mechanism to unlock it.
Okay, so it's more of like enabling the innovation rather than just
blocking
it.
Totally.
Could you maybe give us a specific case where you feel like a company is already doing this really well?
Yeah, so for example, there are a lot of companies that have invested a huge amount of money and they are unable to actually use those systems because they're too scared. They're saying it's too risky, it's going to have too much of a negative impact on our customers. We just don't feel confident. And there you see, they might have put in sometimes $100 million, $150 million, but actually they can't get any value from it. And then, like, you've seen some other companies that are just, like, transforming. I saw recently, I forgot the name of the company. It was the guy who founded Twitter, or X, Dorsey. And then he started another company. I think it's a payments company. I think it's a fintech. And I think got rid of half the staff because they've been using now AI engineers. They use these kind of AI tools to code. Mm-hmm. So I get that kind of intuition. You know, you'll see these more agile companies, maybe less of these legacy companies that just aggressively adopt and experiment with AI. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that they're going to have these huge advantages. So we're at the beginning of this thing.
I just had a tiny question that, like, we didn't kind of think about, but it just came to me now throughout the conversation we had. Obviously, just, you don't have to say that much on it if you don't know much, but with the current trends, like in the commercial market, thinking about, you know, a lot of AI startups use private credit, for example, and a lot of debt to actually, you know, finance these huge companies that they're trying to run,
whether
it's the data centers, just the chips, etc. Like, with a lot of tariffs have been put on actually the, I think it's, I don't remember what the product was called, but just to actually make these chips, you need some sort of elemental from, I think it comes from China, a lot of it. With all those debts and, you know, risks of private credit, etc., going on, do you think there's some sort of like risk into the market actually crashing and a lot of investors, but also these AI startups and companies are trying to incorporate them, having a huge disadvantage of, you know, actually focusing on governance or compliance or just trying to just expand the AI use?
No, so I guess I wanted to challenge the idea that I think they can't adopt at scale without governance. So that was the kind of first point I wanted to make. But more generally, if you're asking about are we in a bubble, everything indicates that we're in a bubble. Like the whole thing is the whole US stock market seems to be driven by, the amount of capital that's gone into AI companies and the promise of AI. Now, I thought it would have burst by
I did
now.
too.
So like I thought we would.
we had a guest that didn't agree with you.
We had one of our guests, Daniel Long, actually, to mention him, he was talking about the supply and demand of AI and how that will kind of create a protective layer over the bubble. But I don't know, with the recent, like, OpenAI, looking at OpenAI, the founders, like, promising, I think, 100 billion profit by 2029. That was, like, the recent thing I read. But to actually get any sort of profit, they're already in, like, 44 billion debt, and I think they already had a lot of loss. So how does that work?
So I was about to like plead ignorance on the question of whether or not it's going to burst or not, because I think who knows about this thing? There's a very powerful argument to say that that's not the case. It won't. We're not in kind of bubble that we think it is. But like I said, my intuition was that yeah, we late obviously are. And but that other question that you're asking is very different, which is it makes total sense for a tech company to be losing money. Their whole point of what they do, like so the famous example is Amazon. I don't think it turned a profit for God, was it most of its history, because they're just aggressively growing the business and trying to dominate the market. So it will absolutely at some point it needs to solve itself, right? These companies need to become profitable and all the rest of it. But I think something I've noticed recently, I mean, reflecting on recently, is that I think there was so much attention on AI that we're forgetting that we're still very much at the early stage. So they think that some people think it's the value of these businesses, they're undervalued, because they're going to be these huge behemoths. It's just very speculative.
I've been actually like really interested in Gemini and just Google DeepMind lately, and I think it's the person who's running it. I forgot the name. I'm so sorry if you're listening to this. You're probably
But
not.
Dennis.
But his point, he made a point about he sometimes feels like AI should have been kept in the labs until it became maybe, I don't know, more efficient, more fluent in what it does. And should that be the case? Should it not be the case? We don't know. But it's out now. We're kind of scared of it. We don't know what's happening. I mean, there's always some sort of like uncertainty with any sort of new product that comes to the market. So, like you said, I agree.
But he can say that because he would have been in Google with hundreds of billions of dollars of capital, So look, this whole thing, we have a system which allows speculative capital to go into all of these kind of technologies, and they're high risk investments, but they result, but they're hoping that they just put their money into the next Google.
Thank you. It's
Awesome.
been a really informative discussion just for us to understand the, broader scope of what governance is as well. So thank you.
Fantastic.
Yeah, this has been
Awesome. Thank you
exciting.
so much for the invite.
Of
Yeah, of
course, thank you
course.
for coming.
Thank you for accepting.
Yeah. Just one
Fantastic.
thing for the listeners, follow us. I think we're probably going to have one more episode for this year. We have exams coming up, so unfortunately, we'll have like probably two more coming up, but that'll be it. Thank you so much for joining our Insight into the World of Artificial Intelligence series. We hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, and follow us on Spotify and Instagram so you don't miss what's next.
Of course. See you next time.